This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series. Hello.
Hi.
Oh my God. So long.
It's been a long time. This is easily the longest we have gone in a season. It feels like outside of that too.
It feels ridiculous, but I'm back. I'm partly human again. Not quite, but I'm returning to the world. I don't look like it though. Let's not post this photo up on online.
What have you been doing? Have you been running or...
I did run this morning. No, this morning I have the delightful, I'm just going to name her, the delightful Jill Langer here, who has been helping us and helping me, and she's getting me back on track after this little time away, and she's kept us on track, as have you, picking up all the podcasty things. Thank you so much for doing all the work while I was.
I've done a heap of work, but I would commend Jill. She's even trying to sort out tax things, which is so complicated.
I'm so glad it's her. And you know, last night I was driving and I was listening and catching up on your chat with Hazel Edwards, and I felt so seen when she said that she was saying something about her husband being an accountant and that he's always looked after the admin. And she said something about writers being notoriously bad at their accounts and managing themselves as a business. And I concur, and I feel seen. And one needs someone like Jill to sort them out, or at very least needs to be good at spreadsheets like you are, Catherine Collette.
I think the financial spreadsheets are their own beast. Even the words debit and credit are just the most misleading words in the accounting. They don't seem to cross over. Like they... A credit card versus it just is the most inconsistent naming of things. That discussion with Hazel Edwards was interesting just because she has hustled.
She really has.
Yeah, it was really interesting from that perspective how you make a living. And she's very candid about that.
Yeah. I love, you know me, I love candor. We love candor here on the podcast. So let's be candid. How have you been?
I've been
good. Last 3 weeks. Can I ask a question first?
Yeah.
I want to know about the winter solstice swim.
Oh, the winter solstice swim was great. I took all these photos that I intended to put on Instagram and have done nothing.
Please do.
So it was a Sunday night. I don't know if that was the official winter solstice day, but I think maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. It was great. So we were allowed to swim in wetsuits. There's another winter solstice swim in Tasmania, which we're going to do next year, that is naked.
I've seen pictures of that one.
So we'll do that next year. This was great. So we had wetsuits on. You were assigned a particular wave and there were 8 people in your wave. You had a little, it's like a belt with a bit of rope attached and then this floating sort of bag that had a light in it. It was about 8. Yeah, it was actually quite beautiful. So you could see as you were waiting for your wave, you saw everyone with their bags lit up and it was pitch black. You see them get into the water and then these little lights just go across the water and they have a kayak and the kayak has a more significant light attached to it. And then they have a really competent swimmer behind you and you sort of swim following the kayak. So there's all these lights and then there's the lights of the city and it's really pretty. But when they get you to go in the water, they assign you, there were 8 people in the wave. And so they assign you a number and they said, we're going to stop every however long at buoys or at poles and we'll do a count off and you'll need to say your number so that we know that everyone's there.
So like we only really, excursion.
Yeah, exactly. But we only really stopped twice and each time they stopped because it was actually a much harder swim than I thought it would be. It was only sort of 1.5K, but it was really weird swimming in the dark.
Dark.
And you don't really know where you're swimming. You've got no sort of sense of how far you've gone or really where other people are. It's quite disorientating. But when they stopped and they were meant to get us to say our numbers, they just said each time, is everybody here? which is like, well, I
that's
am.
How you leave the kid behind.
Exactly. Haven't you watched Home Alone? Like, just yeah, so it was good, but it felt harder. I think it's one of those things. I'm glad to have done it. I'm not chomping at the bit for another night swim. It's a bit
Did you have like little booties on your feet?
I had booties on. I was like smothered in neoprene. I just was, yeah. But still, it was freezing, like absolutely freezing. But for the first time, normally we just get dressed by the side of the, you know, where the water is. There's lots of sort of half-naked people doing the same thing. This time we went into the clubhouse because they had a big dinner afterwards and they had a steam room. And so we all got undressed in the steam room.
Oh, that is good. I feel deeply satisfied by that already. Okay. Really amazing. Good.
But yeah, now working up to the Tasmanian version, which I think is less about actually swimming and more about nudity and dipping into the water.
Yeah. Okay, amazing. Yeah. So will you still do this one again as well?
I don't know. I think I ended up going for another bay swim the following week in the morning, and that was far more enjoyable.
Yeah.
So maybe not. But you see, just the way that the light goes through the water, I think phosphorescence is about that. You can, even though there's no light in the water, you can see the bubble. Like, it's quite a weird.
Yeah.
It's lovely weird, but it's also eerie weird.
Very brave, very important solstice doing things.
It was good. What have you been doing? Have you just taken time out?
I have taken time out. So people would know if they follow my Instagram, my beautiful, beloved grandmama died. So it was just a lot of the work of that, you know. It's work doing death stuff as well as all the grieving stuff. So we have I've taken time out. We had a little bit of extra time before the funeral, which was a beautiful, beautiful day at Motzelvat. And then coincided with school holidays. I just fully took time off. It's exhausting too. I got lots of lovely messages on my socials too. So thank you to people who did that. But yeah, and people all said, it's just exhausting. Grief is exhausting.
It's really exhausting.
Yeah.
And so, even when some of the practicalities of it are taken away in terms of food drop-offs and like that all stuff really helps, but it's draining. Like there's highs to it, there's lows, there's admin,
there's admin. I'll tell you what is a delightful thing that people that I will note as a writerly thing for our writers is that my grandmama would never have said that she was arty in any way, despite the fact that she painted and did pottery and all sorts of things. But what we have found as we have gone through the house is notes everywhere, notes in books, notebooks, the most beautiful writing everywhere. So it's a glorious thing to leave your thinking around the place for someone else to find. Notes of moments, messages to us at different times, lovely things about the family, responses. The best ones are like cutout articles or magazines or newspaper articles where she's been cross at the person who's written it or emphatically agreed and like underlined things and exclamation marks and made some notes as well.
What a joyous discovery.
Yeah, so they're really lovely. It's like having an ongoing conversation. So that has been very, very delightful. So it's been a lot of that and a lot of, I'm going to move the camera so you can see the books piling up behind me because I haven't necessarily been able to read, but we'll talk about what we've been reading in a moment.
Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Ultimo Press, and we are very, very excited to be talking to Peruz Jafari about his debut novel, 40 Nights. Born in Iran, Peruz Jafari migrated to Australia more than two decades ago as an ambitious photographer. His experience of witnessing violations of human rights of every imaginable kind throughout his childhood, adolescence, and young adult life in Iran ignited a passion in him to pursue legal studies, and Peruz graduated as a lawyer in Australia in the summer of 2003. Peruz has since worked in various community-based organisations and statutory bodies. 40 Nights is his first literary fiction novel. Welcome, Peruz.
Thank you so much for having me, Catherine. It's a pleasure to be here with you. Yes, it's exciting being a first-time novelist. Who would have thought?
It is exciting, and I want to get into all of it. Firstly, and I did say this off air, a massive congratulations on the book for listeners. It is an extraordinary read, the kind of book that stays with you. Peruse, can you tell us what is it about?
Yes, thank you for the nice comments. Look, the book is about a guy who is an immigrant from Iran, and he's got a small legal practice in the western suburbs of Melbourne, and his clients are mainly refugees and humanitarian entrants. And through the work that he does with a particular client, who wants to bring her orphan relatives from war-torn Somalia, he starts reflecting back on his own experience of civil rights violations and all sorts of conflict in Iran during his childhood and then adult life. And he starts remembering, his life in Iran, and also he carries a very, very special tale that unfolds throughout the book.
He does carry a very special tale. The title of the book is 40 Nights. You do talk to this a little bit in the very beginning, but what is the significance of the title? What does it mean to you?
It means a lot. So 40 Nights it's kind of the phrase is a direct translation from winter solstice that has a very, very special place in Persian mythology. It's a very ancient tradition which is celebrated across the world. And basically the eve of 20th or 21st of December is when in the Northern Hemisphere people celebrate, people who celebrate winter solstice, that's when, the significance of the night is. Now, this is a tradition that has always been celebrated in my family and amongst many, many, many Persians. And the story two elements to it, and the significance of it is a two-pronged. One is the cultural relevance of it and how special that is in my heart and in my culture, but also the relationship that it has with other parts of the world. And so it's the eve of winter solstice that the character in the book gets to know this person who is from medieval Gotland, and she also has a tale about winter solstice in her time, which is 14th century, and that start talking about lots of things that happens.
Peruse, it feels like there is a lot of you in this book, and I mean that both in terms of similarities between you and Tishtan, the protagonist, but also in an emotional sense. There is a real honesty and a truth and an insight that imbues the work. I wondered, was there a particular moment or a particular event in your life that made you realise that you wanted to write this story?
I think it was something that was kind of growing within my being all along. And I think it just kind of grew and grew and grew, and it came to a point that it needed to get out. It's almost like a seed that, keeps germinating in soil and then suddenly pops. And I think it just reached that maturity and it just needed to be presented to the world. It was quite a profound moment when it all happened. And funnily enough, it was the eve of, it was around winter solstice, Northern Hemisphere winter solstice in 2016 when I decided, that's it. I have to dump all of this onto paper.
And I know that you're a photographer, but did you have a background in writing?
I didn't have a background in writing. I always wrote and essay writing, because obviously I went to school in Iran and university. Essay writing was always a very, compulsory and integral part of my studies. And my mom was a literature teacher, so she always emphasized on good writing. And we had lots of conversations about poetry and writing. Mom self-published her poetry and memoir as well. So it was always, in me, and it was always encouraged and nurtured. So not officially, no, but unofficially, yes, if that makes sense.
Well, it's worked out. So 40 Nights goes between, as you sort of have mentioned, it goes between present-day Australia, 1980s Iran, Somalia, some of those sort of time periods and places link with individuals' presence and their pasts. There's always also this thread around 14th century Gotland, yes, which of all places and things. Tell us about Gretel and Gotland. How did they come to be part of the work?
I guess it is something that's very difficult to explain, but a part of me ever since I was little was really drawn to the Nordic region, beyond, you know, for reasons beyond my own comprehension. And again, it was a tale that just kind of grew up and grew old with me all these years. And I guess in my heart of hearts, it was a familiar story. Now, I invite readers to apply their own interpretations as to what that means. You know, if people believe in past life, great. It could be a past life intuition, you know, things that you just connect with. Or if you think that's just, you know, I have an overactive imagination, and that's also fine. I guess, you know, that part of the story is, you know, it's an invitation from me to the readers to challenge their ideas of what's true and what's not true, what's mm-hmm. reality and what's not reality. And, you know, people are entitled to interpret the story however way it resonates with them.
That's right. It belongs to the reader once it's in the world, doesn't it? Yeah. I think also to me that inclusion of the 14th century storyline gives this sense of echoing of history too, doesn't it? That these experiences of dispossession just keep absolutely playing out.
Absolutely. And I was deliberate in joining, I guess, connecting that thread. And I guess for the purpose of this book, the thread only goes, like, spans from 14th century to 21st century. But in all reality, for centuries, for a lot longer than that, humans have been invading countries and eradicating cultures and traditions and committing all sorts of atrocities. So, yes, absolutely. So that is definitely a common thread. The other common thread is the role of mothers and grandmothers mm-hmm. in keeping traditions alive, keeping language alive and cultures and being the heroines of their time, of all this throughout history.
Yeah, there's a lot of dark, but there's a lot of light too. The love really comes through. We know that the book ultimately found a home with Ultimo Press. Can you tell us how did it find that home? What was the path to publication?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. So I guess because of my upbringing and with my mom being so pedantic about, you know, doing things properly and then making sure that, you know, it's all the, you know, checks and balances are done. I was very particular about the process. So when my final draft was finished, I sought a professional editor to tidy it up and make it presentable. Sam Cooney was the
editor. That's a very professional editor.
And he's a wonderful guy to work with. And he was very generous with his time and he really poured his passion into it, this exactly the same way I had. And together we worked on you know, refining the draft so that it was in the best shape possible to present to the publishing world. At that point, I thought about pitching to publishers directly or utilizing an agent, a literary agent. And again, you know, I trusted that agents know what they're doing. They know the market. They know the publishers intimately. And otherwise, I would have gone blind. And it may or may have not succeeded. I don't know. But I chose the path of using the expertise of a literary agent. So then that was the next step. So I engaged Grace Heifetz from Left Bank Literary. And so she again, in turn, did her bit to present the work to the, you know, wonderful publishers out there. And Ultimo Press was, you know, it.
Oh, that's a good story. Yeah. Peruse, we are always after writing advice on this show. What is either the best or the worst advice you have either been given or can offer about writing?
Look, I think advice works different for different people. I presented the first few chapters to an author, a well-known author, and they completely demoralized my sense of writing. And they said, this has no hope and it's probably good for, you know, to be shelved for now, and maybe in years to come you can come back to it.
Must feel like a validating moment, does it?
It was. In fact, for me, it worked the other way. And I thought, nah, do you know what? You know, my work is good, because a lot of people were saying, this is a beautiful story. I was lucky enough to be mentored by Emily Bitter, and she always, you know, encouraged me along and gave me really, really constructive feedback. So she had worked with me for a long time until the manuscript was complete. So I guess the best advice is be true to yourself. That's, you know, integrity of story is what then shines through. I think when we start listening to this person, that person, and we want to apply a rigid formula in writing, that's when it loses itself, loses the spirit. And the worst advice is, I guess, all that I have received is to have a, you know, regimented approach. I think you just need to be comfortable in your own storytelling and follow your soul. Mm-hmm. Now, earlier on, you said there's a lot of sense of myself and feelings in it, and that is absolutely true. I literally poured my heart and soul into this, and you know, I thought everything else will work out, like in terms of the grammar and editorial process, it will all work out. But the essence needed to be there, and that was my mission. And I feel it's accomplished.
Yeah, I agree. Mission accomplished. Peruse, our final question, we always ask people to recommend another debut book. Can be from any author, any genre, any place that it has come from. Do you have a recommendation for us?
Oh, that's a very, very tough question. I guess along the same themes, There Was Still Love by Fabel Perret. Is it Perret? Sorry, I apologize if I say the name wrong. I believe that was her debut novel.
Yes, it's a wonderful book.
It is a wonderful book. I absolutely love that book. I think I finished it in one sitting. That would be my recommendation. But like, there are so many. It's really, really hard to pick one.
Excellent. Now, the book, I've lied about that being the final question. The book comes out, will be out by the time this episode is released. Do you have events coming up? Where can our listeners find you?
Yes, we've got lots of things locked in. So for starters, the launch will be on the 6th of July at the Bowery Theatre in St Albans from 5:30 to 7:30, including, you know, refreshments and that. And then the next event is at Geelong Library and Heritage Centre on the 27th of August. Details are yet to be announced, but yeah, and then there are other things that I am not able to talk about just yet.
We will link to those events in our show notes. Thank you, Peruse Jafari, for being on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
You posted something momentous on your Instagram, which was that you handed in your middle grade manuscript.
Yes, I sent it to Jacinta and to Danielle, and I'm in the waiting phase.
Oh, so gosh, the waiting phase.
Really busy. I think it's been 5 weeks today.
Have you resisted the urge to send a few little emails?
I had resisted the urge, but Danielle got in contact about something and I did slip in a housemate. She had set expectations at the start in terms of it's going to be a while. You know, there's a lot on, all that sort of stuff. Okay.
waiting game.
It's such a, it's that hold your nerve moment in.
Yes.
Some ways, because you can be so, you can interpret silence. Like, I know she hasn't read it, but the way that you still interpret silence and place value on silence and it's horrible.
Also, the expectation that we all have somewhere deep inside ourselves, which is that even though we know rationally that they don't have time and that they've already told us they're not going to read it, they're just going to be waiting for a coffee and they're going to open up their email and go, actually, I've got to read this genius brilliance. And then we're going to get the email that says, exactly, this is in fact the best manuscript I've ever seen in my entire life, and it's going to change your life. I mean, that is what we're all hoping for, right?
And I could not put it down.
I cancelled all my meetings for the day.
That's right. Oh, God. I'm still waiting for that. So hopefully she opens that first page any moment now.
Any moment.
And, is
Danielle, if you're listening. open that email.
Oh, it's so hard. I haven't been in that situation for a long time, and it's yeah.
So are you doing what everyone who we've ever spoken to has recommended, which is to get on with the writing, that that's the only thing you can do?
I think life has just been way too busy.
Yeah.
And I think I'm a bit worn out as well. Like, so it's been nice to have a break. I had a couple of events with Tony Jordan.
Yes. How did you go? Oh, my gosh. Did Carney come to your event?
He did. So I had one with Tony and Jackie Byron, who's ace, and Lynn Yewalt hosted. That was great. That was at Queenscliff. Carney and I stayed overnight. And then I had another one with Tony at Williamstown Writers Fest, which is such a sweet little festival as well. But Tony was saying, I think she said, so she had finished a book and then she was starting to, another author said that they were starting to write something new and they realised the importance of the break.
Yes.
And so this author was saying four months, I think.
Yeah.
So
going fellow.
I
that's
feel like
Vicky
I'm
Hastrich's
relaxing,
going
yeah, I feel
fellow.
Like relaxing into that, and I have an idea, and it's sort of gathering. Maybe they gather little images or kind of vaguey things that you think, well, they go together in some sort of way.
Build up.
But it's actually been nice. Yeah, it's been nice to have a break and to chill out a bit.
Nice. Excellent. And school holidays, because aren't they a joyous time?
Well, you've just got to write them off, don't you?
Oh my God. But why do I forget every time?
I know.
You just have to write them off.
Well, even recording is hard. I've had to stroll around saying, do not open this door. Just this is like, this is a firm door shut.
Bribery. Bribery all the way.
Oh, bribery. Bribery and TV is like, where would you be?
Where would you be? Okay, tell us about your TV then. What have you been watching? Nice segue.
Well, I must say reality TV is really, maybe it's to do with American summer and all of that stuff. There's not been a lot happening. Beverly Hills has been giving a bit. Beverly Hills Housewives has been giving a bit, but not quite as much, I think, as perhaps was expected. Southern Charms just restarted, which is set in the deep south of America.
Wow.
Maybe I feel a bit lost at the moment because my reality TV's not happening, writing's not happening. I've been reading a lot. So that's been good.
That's
Tell
excellent.
Me you're watching first.
So my watching has been strange, but one of the things that did capture all of our attention was the Thai cave rescue. The Rescue, I think it's just called The Rescue.
Oh my God.
Have you watched it yet?
Read that book ages ago and I didn't realize how they got those boys out. And it sticks with you.
Yeah.
I can't imagine watching that.
It's incredibly done. The way that they've created the film is incredibly done. But it reminded me, you know how I always rave on about Robert McFarlane Underland, that book, which I just adored. I listened to it and I also read it twice. And he's got a big section on cave diving. And like, I can remember still when we were listening to it, because we were listening to it while we were driving around Australia and like almost not being able to breathe, reading it, hearing him talk about it. And so I had the same experience while I was watching these guys, but also the beautiful interviews. The interviews are very well done. So the interviews with some of the cave divers and just...
Is it a documentary?
It's a documentary, yeah. It's a documentary. And obviously they've had access to some people and not other people as well. So there's a leaning that way. But the cave divers, some of whom are Australian and some Brits and a guy from the US maybe not, a Scot, they're so revealing about the type of people who find cave diving pleasurable. So it was one of those nice moments where you often think when you're building character or how to reveal things about a person, just it's so hard for me to imagine how you would enjoy putting your whole body both underwater and underground and sliding through mud where you can't see and then going on to do this incredible thing that they did in getting all those kids out. Really interesting. I would highly recommend that.
It's such a beautiful, like people coming together for an aim
Yeah.
Like it feels very pure in motive. There's something about it that feels really lovely and really generous and really caring about others.
Yeah. Mm. It's an uplifting one. If you need a bit of an uplift, go with that.
But the claustrophobia of it is like,
no, too much. Okay, so go on. Tell me about all these things that you've been reading.
Well, I must admit, I was going to start with articles. I had a lot of. Go. I've been living for the Miles Franklin.
Oh, my Lord. All right, let's go there.
It's so interesting. Well, I don't know if we should, because it does detract from the goodness of shortlists and all that sort of stuff. But there are some.
But we'll go there anyway.
I just think one article in particular is worth a mention, and it's by John Purcell, who wrote The Girl on the Page. It's just his website, so it's a blog post called John Hughes, Plagiarism and a Literary Award Gone to the Dogs. Good title, because John Hughes is the author of the book The Dogs that's been accused of plagiarism. One of the things that he talks about within this article, so there's been a lot of discussion about plagiarism as the extent of plagiarism within this book, The Dogs, has been revealed over time.
Yep.
But there's been some analysis by academics, I don't know if you've heard of this, that are looking at, because there is so much plagiarism within this book, they're actually interested in it as a work almost of art in and of itself. So the theory is it moves away from plagiarism, and it's a, you know, as the scale is enormous, it is a different form of art. The issue is, which is widely acknowledged, is that it's art if you've attributed it to the other authors. If you're just sort of robbing people blind and cobbling something
together.
But
also, didn't we learn that back in the day when we were doing our, you know, VC and the rest of it, your statement of intention, say what you're doing. Like if it was a gag, if it was a hoax, great.
It's never going
to be. Clearly not.
Exactly.
Of that terrible attempt to justify himself in The Guardian, which was didn't have a PR. He did not have a spin person helping him with that.
Audacious. And like something only arrogance. I think a white man could.
Only a white man, yeah.
Tweon did an article on Arts Hub about the top 10 Australian literary scandals.
Oh, nice.
It's a nice little summary. I think she might have posted on Binders or something to get some input or ones that people had remembered. It's a really interesting article. But similar to that, why don't you just put a statement of intent? There's a thread of, or there's a couple of memoirs that end up being untrue, which feels like a really odd choice given fiction is an option.
Fiction is always an option.
It's like fiction is not an option. Fiction is an option. Like, it's so weird.
Oh, I want to read that. I want to read that because, you know, I am always here for a lit scandal. I think one of the interesting things, because I was actually with a group of my darling friends who are not writers and attempting to explain it, obviously is not as juicy, but they all had heard about it, you know, just that it hits every button for a writer, you know, it hits every button all the way down for any writer. But while we are here talking about the Miles Franklin, we will actually say the shortlist, which is the shortlist books that have not been disqualified from the Miles Franklin, 100 Days by Alice Pung, I loved, and we talked to her last year, and my goodness me, so glad. Bodies of Light by Jennifer Down, Scary Monsters by Michelle de Kretzer, who we've also spoken to about that book, The Other Half of You by Michael Muhammad Ahmed, and of course the big one that everyone's talking about, Grimish by Michael Winkler, the previously self-published and now on the Miles Franklin shortlist.
That's got to be... I mean, that's a great news story, isn't it? What a, you know, I think that's such a good one. I think what is so lovely about that story is the degree to which, I mean, he's obviously written a great book and, you know, has struggled to find a traditional publisher for it in the beginning. But how much that book was supported by individuals who read it. I think it made its way to Helen Garner through someone at Blarney's Books. Sent it to Helen Gart. Like it just, I think Bram Presser was a real advocate for it. Yeah. It's a lovely...
It's a lit world good news story.
Yeah,
and in fact, really You know what I was going to say, I haven't been listening to much. What I have been listening to is the gorgeous Jacinta Parsons, who is also, I have to say, doing is a candidate in the same PhD course that I'm in. So she is looking at the kind of community building that she does through her afternoon program on Radio Melbourne. And she totally kept me going through the last 3 weeks when I've been a little bit discombobulated. But she had a talk back, or she had a segment with Tim Byrne from Avenue Bookstore.
Oh, yes.
Also yep. a critic, et cetera. And he was talking about both Grimish and also another book, which we'll put a link in, by Monica Rosevsky, a debut Australian who had to go through, I think, the US to get published first. And he was basically just saying, he let loose really about Australian publishing and why they're not taking risks on things, and that they're just at the moment going, you know, for the mid-list, which I don't completely agree with, but not mid-list, sorry, middle brow, like just straight aiming for the middle rather than taking risks on things. And he was using the example of these two books as saying, here is some exciting writing that you lot all refuse to publish. So interesting, but lovely to listen to Tim Byrne and JP chat on about books as well and get that kind of coverage for them too.
I also think, like, I agree with that. I also think it's not easy to be a publisher, is it?
It's
like, it's so difficult to pick something.
Yeah, and I also think that there is an element that there is really exciting stuff being published by smaller presses in Australia as well as bigger presses, and it doesn't necessarily always come to the top either, which is or see the light of day in terms of press, because as we know from the number of incredible books that we get sent, there is not enough time or space in any day to either read them or even shout out to them. There's just so many. So interesting discussion that I think the inclusion of Grimish on the Miles Franklin shortlist will continue to, have an impact on. Okay, so other reading.
One, well, two, and I feel like we shouldn't mention featured books because it feels like we shouldn't, but two that I just read in the last sort of week and both really enjoyed, and they're both very, very different. Alex Sarkis's Something Blue.
Excellent.
Which is set in the west of Sydney, young sort of 20-year-old girl, Lebanese sort of background growing up in the west. And the other is Peruz Jafari's 40 Nights, which is set across multiple time periods and places, but a lot of it takes place in Australia and is about kind of dispossession from land and refugees and those sorts of things. Great books, books that... the fact that we have this featured book section shuffled them up to the top of my to-be-read pile.
Yes.
And it was a bit like, maybe this isn't the best analogy, but that thing in high school where you're told you have to read a book and it pays off. Just interesting books, different books, and both debuts. So highly recommend.
Hot debuts. Excellent. I'm so looking forward to hearing those conversations with you as well. I wanted to recommend, because I finally finished it. I know I have talked before about that I had started The Rider Laid Bare by
Ali Kaufman. I just got this. It's sitting at my desk.
So I did the first half, maybe, while I was away trying to write, because that's something that I tend to do, take away like a craft book to give myself little hits in between the writing sessions. And then I just finished it over this last week. And gosh, she's good. She is so good on articulating aspects of craft, of writing craft. She also just has, it seems like, this encyclopedic knowledge of writers, and able to bring in examples from different writers and different pieces of text. She's also, which I think we know already, and you've interviewed her before as well, from her memoir and her other nonfiction work, willing to put it all on the page. You really feel like you are getting the truthiness that she's not holding back. And there's this beautiful section, the end section really, really just spoke to me so much. There's a section on The pram in the hallway and the choice of becoming a parent and how that's interacted with her writing work. There's also a section on, I think it's just called, yeah, the writing times and the living times, which was, I was going to refer to it before in that time of, it talks about needing to take a break and replenish after a book, but also about kind of what you miss out on if you're just punishing yourself to kind of be at the desk every day and all day, and the things that we need, which I certainly find to sustain us to keep writing. But the one that I wanted to read out from is from a whole chapter on literary friends, which begins with an anecdote about an unnamed writer who, honestly, Lee, you can just email us and tell us if it's actually me who you're thinking about. But like a section on joint jealousy, or on someone who's going like, oh my gosh, like stop being so nice on social media to everyone, which I think all writers can totally understand. But there is this, and I quote, she says, "I see my friendships with other writers, particularly those that have provided oxygen for my art and kept me honest about it, as an inseparable part of my writing process. I see them as the ultimate intersection of life and art." And it was just the loveliest section on, you know, deep writerly friendships, but also all of those other, you know, connections and collegiate kinds of moments and conversations, and even kind of online friendships that we have with other writers that are sustaining. So I just, I can't recommend it enough. I think it's so great.
She is so giving of emotion in all of her work. I think I'm not surprised that that is the case in that book. I like that that subtitle, Mastering Emotional Honesty in a Writer's Art, Craft and Life. That feels very Lee Kofman to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also that advice that she gives so often, and she gives it again in this book, which is write what makes you blush, which I think I should stick on as one of my post-it notes up here. But because the other book I wanted to recommend, which I is the only other one that I could finish in this strange time I've been having, is this one, Desire, A Reckoning by Jessie Cole, which is out with Text Publishing very soon. So I'm thank you to Text for getting me an early copy with some beautiful seeds that Jessie sent along with it. This is Jessie Cole has written, I imagine, What Makes Her Blush. It's a book about wanting and desire and embodied kind of trauma and desire both, and having to deal with them. Anyone who's read Staying, which is Jessie Cole's previous memoir, would know she's both an incredible writer and also that truthiness on the page. But I could not put this down. I absolutely could not put this down.
Had you heard about elements of that book prior to it?
No, okay. I hadn't at all. I knew that Jessie Cole was writing something new. I had no idea what it was about. It is about a relationship with an older guy not during COVID, but I think she wrote it during the lockdown. And it's about, you know, love and desire in general. And it's just, it's really, really good. I recommend it.
I love that. One other article, which is not necessarily writing related, but I really liked it, was I don't know if you saw Lee Sales is obviously finishing up at 7:30, but she wrote an article where she interviews herself.
Oh, I did not see that.
It's really cute. It's just really nice. But she writes a bit, or she talks to herself, I suppose, a bit about interviewing different prime ministers. It's just a really interesting insight in that you don't really think about the fact that someone like her, who I think she's interviewed Scott Morrison more than 50 times, for example, that these relationships that inevitably form between politicians and journalists in this case. But it's such a positive article. She says nice things about, well, first she says that being prime minister is a really tough gig and that she has a lot of respect for anyone who does it. But she says a lot of nice things about all of the recent prime ministers. And she also just talks to a couple of special relationships with particular ones. Paul Keating is one, and she sort of has a few nice anecdotes. It's such a lovely article.
Let's put that in the show notes so that I can remember to read that one. I love a good, that's how I ended up doing handing in my stuff for my dissertation was an interview with myself. And so I've been looking at a lot of them and I quite like it.
Well, Hazel Edwards' biography feels a little bit like that. I think the beauty of it is you know what stories you want to tell, what a yeah. good, you know, and what you've thought about. So it's sort of, as a device, it's really effective. Semi-linked to that, one of the things I've been listening to is, of all things, not something I ever thought I would listen to, but Matthew McConaughey's memoir, Green Lights.
Oh, my gosh.
Audible. Have you listened to this?
Yes, I have.
Oh, yes, my God. I was like recommended this so many times. People
say, I recommended it to really you. Good. It's Catherine Collette.
I would not listen to anyone. I was like, not really into Matthew McConaughey. I basically thought he was the character that he played in Dazed yeah. and Confused, essentially. Then when that recent primary school shooting happened in the US, I saw on Instagram that he did like a presentation to Parliament that was really yeah. anti-guns. And it sort of made me think, oh, I wouldn't have expected him to do that. So I borrowed it on Audible. It's so damn good.
It's so good.
It's so good. It's a really easy thing to listen to. Here is a guy who has a great attitude to life, can tell a story, and has brilliant stories to tell, plus the Southern accent, which is just Greenland. Cherry on the cake. I'm now president of his official fan club. It's so good.
I have listened, honestly, I listened to it a few times. I think I listened to it. I took it to one of the festivals and I have, you know, I like play an audiobook.
I can't stop listening to it.
As like your background to just kind of keep you pumped. So I did that. But also I think on one long car trip, we just listened to the Australia chapter.
I was going to say the Australia bit.
3 or 4 times.
I didn't get it. I had driven home from work and didn't get out of the car. I was just like, these doosleys, like
it is
so... And escalation, just like, oh, it's really good.
It's so good.
I cannot think of many people that would not enjoy this. And I think it's such a good one for audiobook.
Yeah, I concur. I'm so glad that we are on the same page on that one. We still talk about it while we're camping. I love that so much. Okay,
tell us. They're hilarious. The Doosleys are ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. But the way he tells, you know, the way he tells the story, and I think, when was I thinking about you and having to, I think it was before the funeral and like trying to work out, you know, how to shape a story and how to speak at a high stakes kind of thing. And I was like, Catherine would have all the details on this. From your experiences of how you craft a story in the telling. And that's what he does with that Australia chapter. Like there's a few different ways you could have come at that, but the way he does it, the way the stakes keep rising, it gets more funny and more ridiculous the further it goes in, and he just tells it so well.
And he just nails that innocence of his own perspective too, that he's 18, he's, it's a cultural, gold.
Obviously now we've given him such a big wrap up. We'll be expecting to have Matthew on the show coming up soon as a master's. Have you got anything coming up?
I've got nothing left. Oh, no, I have nothing coming up. I had my last event last month. Oh, no, we have Sorrento. I lie.
We're going to be at Antipodes. We're going to be at Antipodes Bookshop, which is the most glorious little bookshop right at the end of Sorrento. It is on August the 4th, Thursday, August the 4th. Come down and join us. Make a weekend of it. You know, so just... good.
We are planning on doing...
We are planning that. Because I'm actually doing a workshop on the Sunday for Peninsula Work Writers Group, which I think is open to the public. So if it is, I'll put a link in the show notes to that as well. And yeah, it's going to be a delightful, delightful weekend. I've also got one before that on the 21st of July with Alice Robinson and Lee Kaufman, who we were just speaking about.
It's a wonderful trio.
Yeah. It's called Stories to Save the World, because that's what stories can do. It's on at Doncaster Library. So we'll put the link in the show notes to that. But before that, Catherine, I'll just be heading off to Fiji.
Yeah, why? When did this happen? How are you getting to Fiji?
Well, this was meant to happen like 3 years ago. It's a family trip with my in-laws. And it was meant to happen a long time ago. I didn't think that I would make it because grandma has been so unwell. But then she went and died on me. So off we go to Fiji.
All of us.
Yep. I'm assuming this is my kind of first resort experience. So I have bought new resort appropriate bathers that are not camping bathers. I'm planning on afternoon cocktails. I'm thinking it's going to be a little bit. Did you watch White Lotus?
Do they have a kids club?
They have a kids club. They have a kids club. So the kids are kind of excited about that, more excited about the all-you-can-eat buffet breakfast, to be honest. And let's see if Mildon Hall can do resort life.
I think there is a age, time of life where resort life sounds like a pretty spectacular thing. I have seen White Lotus, so watch your back.
I know. But also imagine, as long as it doesn't happen to me or my family, I'm also going to be in deep observational mode, like under my big hat and behind my big glasses around the pool, just like watching shit go down, because then I'll come back and write my own White Lotus, you know?
Oh, that sounds like heaven. Mm. We are, my mum is having her 70th birthday, and as part of that, she is like organising for us, my family, my brother's family, and it was meant to be my other brother who's overseas, but because of quarantine and stuff, he can't come, to go to Darwin, which will be ace. It's going to be fantastic. But we're staying actually just outside of Darwin on a lake called Bennett's Wood. Like, but it's quite basic accommodation. So it'll be
amazing
to your resort, but it will be amazing.
When are you doing that next week?
Yeah, I live on Saturday.
How long have you got?
A week. It's going to be good.
And but you have to go and see, okay, we're going to put this link in the show notes, but I'm not sure I'm going to get this right. I think that the Gouldian finch, I'm going to show what a nerd I am now, has been spotted around Darwin for the first time in many, many years. So the bird people are going nuts for this. It's something to do with the rain, etc. So I'll send you the link to check out the Gouldian finch.
I'll put that on the itinerary. Where we're staying is a man-made lake. We've been assured there are no crocodiles in the lake, but it's proving a very, maybe divisive is not the wrong word, but there's been a lot of discussion about whether you believe that there are no crocodiles in the lake, but they would be freshwater crocodiles. So it'll be an interesting personality reveal, I think, to see who actually gets in the water and goes swimming at this.
Oh my gosh. For everyone, for our darling listeners, when you hear from us next, we will be debriefing and unpacking on the family holidays, whether or not there were crocodiles, whether or not there were any, you know, murders or drug deals in Fiji, and how we survived.
Oh God, don't even say that.
Don't even say it.
Okay. I'm thinking of Chappelle Corby or something you're talking
about.
Oh
God, I'm not thinking of doing any getting stuck in. Although getting stuck.
Oh, you're going to have a great time. I'm going to have a great time too.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.